You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself, Ryan Walker. In this episode, we are examining pre-hospital urgent care with Kate Hardy. What I wanted to do is really look at the anatomy of the Advanced Paramedic Practitioner and Urgent Care Scheme as it stands currently within London. So we're going to examine the discharge to community rates. We're going to look at alternative care pathways and referral rates. We're going to also look at commonly seen pathology for the group and also look at advances in the scheme. And then we're also going to look at, finally, just the aligned training that the scheme receives. So to do this, I have Kate Hardy with me. Kate is an Advanced Paramedic Practitioner in Urgent Care working in London. Welcome to the podcast, Kate.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, I wonder if you could just maybe unpack your background slightly for listeners.
Yeah, sure. So I'm originally from Australia. I trained from 2012 to 2014, and right about the time when the LAS were doing their recruitment in Australia. So 2015, I thought, why not go over to London for 2 years, do some travel, you know, see some sights. And 8 years later, I'm still here. So I started with the LAS in 2015, worked mainly on ambulances for a number of years, did a couple of secondments. So worked for the clinical hub as a clinical advisor on the mental health joint response unit as well. And then December 2020, started with the urgent care APP program, and here we are.
That's fantastic. And Kate, I just wondered, so just to start with, I think my revelation as a paramedic was that a lot of, up to potentially 90% of the workflow was a primary care in origin. And it seems to be more and more of a trend over time that the main work portfolio of a paramedic is primary care. But could I maybe get you to speak to the initial reason for the inception of the Advanced Paramedic Scheme in urgent care?
Sure, yeah. So the APPUC program started in 2017 as a pilot, and the idea was to see if we could have an APPUC car working with a clinician, like an APPUC clinician in EOC, specifically dispatching that car, so sifting through calls, triaging calls, and finding appropriate calls that could benefit from an APPUC, dispatching that car to them, and seeing it with a view for hospital avoidance. So I guess the overarching reason was to try and safely manage appropriate patients who contacted 999 in the community without the need for conveyance to ED. So I guess it was driven, like, first and foremost by wanting to improve patient care. So we all know that unnecessary conveyances to ED is pretty detrimental to a lot of patient groups for a variety of different reasons. I guess it was seeing what role the LAS could have in trying to manage those, like, those appropriate patients in the community, and then also obviously lessening the burden on hospitals, on ED departments, kind of being driven by that wider healthcare service situation. I think that was the sort of initial reason for the inception of the scheme.
I think it's also absolutely to your point. It's around exploring alternative care pathways, but also that multifactorial kind of mentorship on scene, whereby you're bringing advanced assessment skills. And to your point, really supporting the wider London Ambulance Service, or LAS, to maybe think differently, explore different options in the lower acuity workload. But to that point, Kate, could I get you to maybe speak to what a day in the life of an advanced paramedic practitioner in urgent care looks like, and how maybe this sort of differs from maybe a paramedic's average day?
Sure. I guess it depends which day you're looking at, because it is quite a varied role. I think that's what drew me to the role in the first place. So you have rotational aspects of the role where you're working a couple of days a month in primary care in a GP practice, a couple of days a month in secondary care in an urgent treatment centre, and then obviously you've got your frontline pre-hospital role. So if we're looking specifically at that that part of the role, so we work on our fast response unit. So we carry all the normal equipment that a fast response unit does, and then we've got our specific equipment to to the APPUC scheme. So things like the razor chair, iStat for point of care, blood testing, urinalysis, some PGDs and medicines. And then we've got our clinician up in EOC who is sifting through those calls, specifically sort of targeting us to dispatch. And then we kind of respond to any type of patient, really. So the day can be quite varied. You can kind of go to a lot of different patients, from minor injury to end of life care. And that's from that targeted dispatch. Generally, obviously, you hope our patients aren't time critical. So you have a little bit longer on scene to do a detailed history taking, really drill down on sort of the chronology of the events, what's led up to that patient calling 999, do a targeted assessment, and then you can make that clinical decision. And because you've got that extra time on scene, you also have a bit of time to, I guess, kind of share the clinical burden of that decision making. So we obviously work in silo by ourselves on the car, but there's lots of opportunity to call specialists, call other healthcare professionals, teams, colleagues, and just talk through your decision making, make any referrals that you want to. So that's kind of a snapshot of a day in the life of an APPUC.
So that's fantastic. And I think we'll talk about aligned education shortly, a little bit further on in the interview, just to get a good mental model of what the education looks like. But just to maybe explore sort of the discharge community rate, and indeed how this maybe compares to a standard paramedic practice. Could you maybe speak to sort of the numbers and or data and or anecdotal experience of how much the APPs are referring in comparison to standard paramedic practice?
Yeah, sure. So I think when we're looking at comparing the APPUC to standard paramedic practice, I think it's really important to again highlight that we're having that targeted dispatch to calls that will benefit or potentially benefit from our skills and benefit from community management. So there's kind of that confounding variable when you're looking at data. In general, the non-conveyance rates for APPUC is approximately 70 to 80% of calls attended, in comparison to DCA, so dual crewed ambulances, which is around about 15 to 20. Again, that's not taking into account conveyances of DCAs to alternative care pathways, SDECs, like same day emergency care. But that's kind of a general snapshot of the differences in discharge community rates.
And the kind of the pathology that you see, Kate, because like you said, it is a targeted response, and you are very much sort of making sure there's potentially value add. But could you maybe speak to just the range of pathology that you would see in an average day?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, we see a really large variety of patients. In general, we'll see most type of patients. So it can range from things like minor illness, so DNV, any sort of urinary sort of UTI symptoms, patients with abdominal pain. ENT presentations are really good as well for community management, something that obviously DCAs don't have, otoscopes and all that sort of stuff, so that's really good. But then we'll also see chronic complex conditions and patients with sort of patient groups like elderly patients, for example, really, really good patient group that benefit from having an APPUC attend, because as we know, they're complex patients with not just chronic conditions, but also a lot of social issues as well that can be addressed. We do minor injury, so any sort of wound closure or wound care, acute obviously, patella reductions as well, so any patella dislocations, and then we've got our sort of specific patient groups that we are also targeted to, so end of life care patients really benefit from APPUC attendance. We've got some end of life care PGDs, and then we do have a bit of extra training around end of life care palliative patients through training sessions and some placements as well. And we also are specifically targeted to patients with learning disabilities and sort of complex needs as well, just to provide a bit, often to provide a bit of extra support for crews on scene if they're struggling with those particular types of patients.
So just looking at the key metrics and accreditations that this scheme aligns with, just from a KPI perspective, because that's a massive criteria of patients. And like you said, every one of those patients has, like you said, got complex needs, has probably got an MDT, so multidisciplinary team approach to their care, which again, it's really great to see the APP scheme interfacing into that MDT, because you can then start to align with their forward trajectory of care and their consistent lasting trajectory of care, rather than this a snapshot in time and then maybe a referral to ED. But could you maybe speak to some of either the KPIs, so the key performance indicators, and or the sort of accreditations that you align with, or as clinicians? Because I think, you know, looking at the APPs in critical care, they've certainly got their RCM level one and ultrasound, and they've got a few other portfolio pieces which they align with national standards. Is it the same with the APPs in urgent care?
So the scheme itself aligns with the Health Education England Multiprofessional Framework for Advanced Practice, mouthful. But basically, the framework outlines the core capabilities for healthcare professionals who are working at an advanced clinical practice level. So that includes working towards or having completed a master's level award or equivalent, so something like a portfolio, and then addressing those capabilities through the four pillars of advanced practice. So your clinical pillar, leadership, education, and research. And so to evidence those and address those, the APPUC scheme has a variety of different modalities to address them. So, you know, from supervision, different kinds of education, both internal and obviously your master's. So that's the main kind of accreditation that the scheme works towards or to align to.
And that's fantastic. Like you said, there's a baseline of standards aligning to the advanced paramedic practice pillars is fantastic. And I think we'll put that in the show notes just so that people can see those pillars of advanced practice, which are fantastic. Like you said, leadership, education, clinical governance. But they're looking also at the training that you receive. Could you maybe speak to the in-house training piece, Kate? How much preceptorship do you get, and also how much sort of on the job training versus academic training do you get?
So there's a fair bit internally, really. So we have some specific training sessions in regards to things like mentoring and leadership, which I think is quite important. It's that's the whole thing about advanced practice, is shifting the focus from just that clinical aspect of the role to some other different aspects. So I think we get a little bit of extra training around mentorship and leadership, particularly with the new cohorts coming through as well. We get specific training sessions in regards to those patient groups that we are targeted to and that we receive crew requests for. So learning disability patients and end of life care patients, palliative patients. So that that looks like either some external speakers coming in and delivering an education session. We have also had some extra sort of placements in London hospices to just see sort of what happens on the other side of palliative care, so inpatient units and community teams. So that's really beneficial. In terms of supervision, we get a fair bit of supervision throughout the year from our different the clinical leadership team, and then we also have peer review shifts that we can book with sort of anyone within the cohort. So it could be within the scheme, so it could be someone from cohort one working with someone from cohort seven, or it could be two sort of the same cohort working together. And that's a really great opportunity to give each other constructive feedback, see how someone else works, which I don't think we get enough of in any kind of ambulance service. So I think that's really great. We also have our clinical governance days as well, which run once a month. And we have peer-led presentations, case-based discussions, external speakers come in. And if there's anything that needs to be addressed in terms of maybe someone needs to be signed off for a particular wound care skill or something like that, that can be addressed then. So there's a fair bit of internal kind of training that goes on, which is really good.
No, that's fantastic, actually. And like you said, it's really good to get that plenary of different experts within the room from different specialities just to teach and indeed to feed into the scheme so that you've got very much an aligned approach to end of life care or indeed complex needs as they go forward. Kate, could you maybe speak to, I understand that sort of a master's or and indeed level 7 education is a fundamental prerequisite and or it's actually asked of you to sort of study at that level within the scheme. Could you speak to maybe indeed even your residual qualifications prior to coming into the scheme and how that master's piece looks like within the scheme?
So it's definitely not a prerequisite to have the master's prior to the scheme, but definitely a prerequisite to do it within the scheme. I had a bachelor, an Australian bachelor degree before joining the scheme. So I don't really know what that translates to here. But it's a 3-year master's that you undertake in advanced healthcare practice. It's part-time. There's allowances made for some people who are coming into the scheme might have already done a couple of units here and there, or they might be almost finishing a master's. So there's a lot of allowances made for continuing that study at, you know, whatever university you are with then. The two main universities we use are St. George's and King's College. And there's also quite a lot of support within the scheme to complete that master's. So there's a lot of support from your clinical leadership team. You can contact them if you need a bit of help with whatever you're working on. There's university days you can take to sort of cover that. So it's challenging, obviously, as any master's is, but there is quite a bit of support within the program to kind of help you get through that.
So Kate, you spoke to the clinical governance days, which are a fundamental part of the scheme, and as you know, as we both are aware, and very much was a theme within London for the last enduring time that I can remember, it is, you know, clinical governance is the start of patient safety, and actually it's fantastic to see that clinical governance days are embedded within the scheme and that you can have different subjects and or case-based discussions as part of a bigger discussion and smaller discussions as well. Could you maybe speak to the governance piece, you know, how it's, you've spoken to already to how it's embedded, but just maybe what you get from the governance and how it's embedded within the scheme and maybe the reflections from peers, how they perceive it.
Yeah, definitely. So it's like I said, we've got our clinical leadership team. So we've got our 2 clinical practice development managers and 5 clinical supervisors. They, as I said, they come out with us quite regularly throughout the year, provide a bit of supervision, and then we've got our peer review shifts. I think coming into the scheme, my own perception of that supervision, which forms a really important part of governance, almost suspicion, which has been reflected from my peers. It's almost like that big brother's watching you. But as you kind of get into it and you realize it is a really important part of patient safety, and you need to be open to having someone say, hey, did you think maybe you should have done this instead, or maybe you could have asked this question instead, or whatever it is. So I think that change in how I look at supervision and as part of governance was really important. And it's reflected a lot in talking to a lot of my peers when they've come into the program, realizing that, you know, actually that's really important, and it's not big brother watching you or anything like that. It's not about you necessarily. It's about making sure that your patients that you're seeing are going to be safe because you're thinking dynamically about your practice and all that sort of thing. So that's a really important part of our governance that we have throughout the year. We've got our SOPs, our standard operating procedures that are written for all our extra skills, procedures, all that sort of thing. And they're written by by APPUCs, obviously in conjunction with key stakeholders and all that sort of stuff. There's also a lot of opportunity to take part in writing those as well and be sort of an active part of that overarching governance that's happening within the scheme. And then we have our CPIs that are specific for us, that, and we all take part in auditing the whole program and just making sure that that's all ticking along nicely. So yeah, I think my perception of governance changed quite a lot when I started in the scheme because of being actively involved in it for my colleagues and then through the auditing as well.
You make a really good point there actually around, you know, I learned so much from peer review shifts in London as well, from allowing other people to speak into your practice, but also seeing other people's practice, how they approach it, their decision-making, the cadence of decisions on scene. And also I learned a lot from clinicians in the APP scheme that would just actually sometimes slow down just to make sure they're not missing anything and actually gather. I had a tendency maybe to run in like a bull in a china shop and try and make decisions, but actually that slow is smooth, smooth is fast. And actually making sure that you know, you appreciate the whole scene, the whole history, learning when and when not to move quickly. And actually, yeah, just taking time to appreciate the wider scene. And you write that piece of allowing people in slow time retrospectively to speak into practice is important as well. Mm. So that it's almost a reflection in practice with a peer, and then on practice retrospectively, looking at cases, looking at slow time decision making, and what was happening slow time, and both, like you said, is an opportunity to learn. But as an adjoiner to that question, Kate, how have you changed as a clinician since you've been part of the Advanced Paramedic Practice Scheme?
I think the biggest thing that changed for me, which I think was a little bit unexpected, was it gave me a greater, the scheme's given me a greater understanding and appreciation of the wider healthcare service and how it affects our patients. So I think when we work, and this is probably true for, you know, every healthcare professional out there, it's really easy to get quite insulated in your own role and what you are doing right there and then for that particular patient. But through the rotational aspects of the APPUC program, so working in primary care, working in secondary care, seeing patients that I have seen on the road before in primary care and realizing, oh, hang on, we can deal with that patient here, or actually no, we need to send that patient to this particular specialist or to A&E, seeing those cogs of the healthcare service and how they work and sometimes don't work together has really given me a lot of insight into, it sounds a bit cliche, but the patient journey and how my practice and my decision making can inform that. And I think that was unexpected for me. I was sort of thinking I would, you know, it would be the suturing and all the fancy skills I'd be quite excited about. But I think that was a really big change in my practice and in how I think as a clinician.
It's really interesting, actually. And like you said, just appreciating the whole patient journey is something, like you said, we don't necessarily are cognizant of because we're not on that journey ourselves. But it can be when you stop and think and or see the patient journey from different aspects, fundamentally from the patient's perspective, but also from aligned healthcare professionals. It's really, I think I can speak to experience where there's, as you were saying, other aligned healthcare professionals speaking into how care looks like after you've handed over. And it really helps your decision-making and or my decision-making when you appreciate the ceiling of care beyond your care. And actually it helps you speak the same language, helps you also maybe assess the patient differently and or appropriate risk and or decision-makings differently based on the continuity of care. And that was really the strength of having in hospital and or referral or rehabilitation specialists helps you appreciate the wider scheme and indeed the wider journey. Maybe could I get you to speak to sort of take home messages for listeners that might be thinking of starting in a role such as this?
It sounds a bit ominous, and I don't want to sound ominous, but I think it's important to be aware that it is a big step up in practice, both from, as you said, from an educational perspective, as we've mentioned, a master's is pretty challenging, and to do that while you're working as well, while you do get a lot of support, is quite challenging. But it's quite a big step up in terms of responsibilities and shifting of the way you think about your practice from that purely clinical pillar to thinking about other different aspects of your practice. So obviously it depends on your professional background, but I think it's important to just think about that it is a big step up, but being aware of that, and things like imposter syndrome and all that sort of stuff, and kind of leaning into it and knowing that it's okay if you don't have the answer for everything. You know, it's a continuing development role. You're never going to get to a point where you go, oh, I know it all now, fantastic, I've done this many years and I know everything now, I don't need to know anything else. You'll always be learning, but it's a rewarding process once I think you kind of lean into that uncomfortable kind of feeling of, oh, I don't actually know what to do in this situation, or what's wrong with this patient. I think that would be my take-home message.
That's fantastic. I really appreciate that, Kate, and just your perspectives on that. And just maybe if you could speak to some sort of salient lessons you've learned from becoming an advanced practitioner since you started the role, either clinical salient lessons and or maybe non-technical, it's entirely up to you.
I think one kind of lesson is that there's a lot you don't know. I think you learn once you get into it, and you start learning lots of different conditions and patient assessment techniques. You kind of realize, like, whoa, there is a lot out there that I still don't know. That's all right. And it's okay to share that clinical burden of decision making. It's okay to ask for advice, whether it's from your colleague up in EOC or other healthcare professionals, or the peds reg at ED or whatever. It's okay to ask for advice, obviously in a structured manner, but that's okay. And I think another lesson that I learned coming into this program, extra skills and extra fancy equipment don't replace detailed and thorough history taking, detailed and targeted assessments. So not to be too trigger happy with that, sometimes less is more. I think those are probably the main lessons that I've learned.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And absolutely to that point, I think it's a fantastic point. Kate, listen, thank you for the last 45 minutes. Really appreciated your time, your perspectives, and indeed just your reflections on practice. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.